Hi, I'm Ali Portee, fashion and lifestyle journalist and editor of Zayla magazine. I've always been interested in biographies and in the stories of people's lives, basically listening to what stirs their souls. Welcome to the Soulful Side of Life, where I let you in on some of my conversations with inspiring people from around the world in fashion, faith, entertainment, music, and entrepreneurship. These are conversations that stir the soul about people's journeys, about the ups and downs of life, and how they have overcome certain situations. I hope that these episodes will inspire your life in some way, so enjoy over a cup of something hot or on your drive to work. This is The Soulful Side of Life and can be found on Spotify Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Maria de Medeiros is Portuguese but grew up in Austria and has lived in France for many years. She's an actor, director, and singer, mainly partaking in European productions, but also she does American films. She got her big break in Hollywood, firstly with the film Henry and June in 1990 and with Pulp Fiction in 1994. I first met Maria during Paris Fashion Week in September 2023 at an art exhibition. During the February-March 2024 Women's Paris Fashion Week, I got to sit down with her, and what a privilege it was in Saint-Germain, that's the neighborhood in Paris, to talk about being a citizen of Europe, how acting found her, and what it was like working with Quentin Tarantino for Pulp Fiction. So enjoy this podcast episode. Pardon the phone ringing in the background, but nonetheless, enjoy it. And I hope that you take away something that you can apply to your life. Well, Maria, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, so my first question is, you're a third culture kid, meaning you were born in Portugal, but you were raised in Vienna, mm-hmm. and then now you live in France. So being a third culture kid, does that impact how you view the world?
I guess it does. It really made me a citizen of Europe and of the world, and I'm always interested about what's on the other side, and the other language and the other perspective. And it was very interesting when I was a child that we often, we were living in Vienna in Austria, but we were going on holiday to Portugal, and often we would make the trip by car, with my mother driving, and
that means you drive through which countries?
Austria, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal.
Wow!
And she was very impressive because she was kind of a language genius, and we would cross the border because there were still borders. And she would switch language, and that really trained our ears and my ears. And so I really love the playing with different languages. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a strong print. And something I noticed very interesting over the years is that somehow, when you change language, you change a little bit your personality. You're driven to, because actually every language represents a certain perspective, a certain attitude towards reality. So you're forced to become someone else slightly when you change language. For instance, I would say that French drives you to a certain rationality, a certain way of perceiving relationships in the world. The Spanish. Spanish has a passion, something that may appear as a little bit brutal. Actually, it's not, but because it's very direct. And so you have to assume that position of being very direct and addressing people very directly. I think it's lovely. Italians, with that beauty of the language, and it's precisely the opposite, because it's all about surrounding the other with poetry. Then of course we do our own interpretations, but this relationship to different cultures has, since I was very small, become very important for me.
Right, and it's interesting you say that, because I've lived in 9 countries, but I only speak English, a little Spanish, because I took that in school. But
which countries did you live in?
US, Spain, UK, Germany, France, Italy, the UAE. I count Saudi because I spent over a month there once, and Lebanon.
Wow.
And though I can't speak any of these languages except the UK, and I a little bit with some Spanish in Spain, I've noticed how in each of these places I live, how people express themselves with hands. Some cultures use hands.
Yeah.
I feel like the Spanish you said a directness, and that's interesting. I'm not fluent in Spanish, so I don't know what you mean by that. But I feel when I look at them, how they communicate, there's this personalness to the language, maybe because they use their hands, and or the way Arabs can be very in your face, it seems, but they're speaking just maybe about bread or water or something that's very normal, but they use the hands, or right. It's a language, I feel, Arabic, that talks at you, not with you, some of the times. And then the way you can see in a souk, in a market, how they are talking to you, and then they'll put their hand on your shoulder, and we don't communicate that way in English, but also, I think they are direct because they're very, masculine.
Yes.
Region in the world. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, it's a beauty to the personality of languages.
Yes.
And how,
yes, absolutely. But it's funny because for a while I thought that maybe the gesture language would be universal. It's absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's very funny. I saw recently beautiful theater show with and by Isabella Rossellini.
Ah, yes.
It's called something about Darwin, Dear Mr. Darwin. It's beautiful, beautifully written and performed. And it is about animals and the Darwin theory. Now, the smile, Darwin's smile, I think.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. I have to... Anyway, it's all about our relationship with animals and her relationship. That's very strong with the animal. But there's a whole part about the Italian gestures, because they have very precise meanings. And if you're not Italian, you don't have a clue.
Yeah. And you're like wondering, what do they mean?
Yeah.
And I feel with the Romance languages, Americans, maybe Brits, I don't know about South Africans and Australians, but we like our space, Americans, and the Spanish like to be close when they talk to
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we're like backing away.
Yes.
Like, you can stay over there, I'm over here, I totally I can hear you, I understand what you're saying. But it's just fascinating.
It is.
I remember when I lived in Spain with a family in 2009, My host father was saying how the Portuguese tend to have a better understanding of Spanish without maybe even studying it versus Spanish who...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Portuguese are... I'm Portuguese.
Yeah.
Are one of those people who always traveled. You know, they crossed the world and they were the first in Japan. And they were big
maybe
seamen.
The first in the Americas, right?
Yes.
Before Columbus?
Yes. And certainly that there's a Magalhães that went around the world for the first time, and Vasco da Gama, big discoverers. Mm-hmm. And then, but we kept that thing with the sea and with the traveling, because we had for many years a lot of immigration also all over the world. There are Portuguese communities, and we love languages. We love many foreigners who go to Lisbon say it's very difficult to learn Portuguese because they don't allow you to, because they immediately jump into your own language and try to please you speaking your own language.
I see. I heard that if you can speak more than one language, you have a higher emotional intelligence versus if you just speak one language. Would you agree with that? And does that, if you have, or if you agree with that, do you feel that as an actor, you are able to relate to characters or jump into characters more easily because you speak?
Yes, I certainly agree with that, because I was telling you, the changing of language already implies a certain change of character too, and the entering someone else's language is a form of empathy. Mm-hmm. I love translation also, written translation, and I think translation is one of the biggest acts of love, you know, because when you translate, you completely go or try to go into someone else's universe, expression, emotions. So yeah, I think in the crossing of languages, always a lot of emotion lies there.
Yeah. When did you know acting was your calling?
Actually, it was quite a surprise for me, because I always thought I would do fine arts. I was one of those children, you know, drawing all the time. And there was a very important Portuguese director, João César Monteiro, very crazy, gifted and crazy, and I always say he's guilty of my career, because he really took me into cinema as I was very young, 15 years old. I was the main character in his film Silvestre, and it was a big... discovery for me, the cinema. You know, I was very attracted to perform, of course. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun, you know, doing performance for the first time, but also the backstage, the back of the camera, immediately interested me a lot. So I think I fell in love with cinema, both sides of the camera, from this film on. But even still there, I thought I would go on. I came here to Paris because I was at French school in Portugal. So I came here to the fine arts, then I started philosophy here, and even though I had done cinema, and I had a friend who insisted that I would present the big, I don't know how you say in English, there's big competition to, you know, you have to do to get into the big theater schools here.
See, like an audition kind
of. But an audition of thousands of people. And he said, you have to try it, you have to try it. And for some miracle, I got in. So I understood that my life had changed, and that was maybe a sign that I should go on with acting.
Yeah, wow. And when you were in school, did you take, I guess, acting classes and that further?
Yeah, and they were incredibly interesting acting classes here at the Conservatoire. It's like the main school here of acting. I had started cinema, it went on, and then I could really study in a profound way that art.
What would you say are some of the differences between American style acting versus European style, or maybe, I don't know if I have to be more specific, French style?
Yeah, I think here there's especially in those kind of very classical schools, there's a relationship to text that's almost sacred, and I think it's a good thing. You know, what they teach us here is that the actor, the performer, we're less than the text. We shouldn't, you know, be or trying to dominate Shakespeare or Molière, or, you know, you have to try and climb up to that level.
Okay.
And so there's a big respect of text, of the way it's said, and I thought it was a fantastic opportunity for me to be able to work with so people so different and from so many origins and cultures, because I think I could make like a synthesis of American school, South American school, because I think in South America there's also fantastic performers, actors that had huge influence on me, like the Brazilians, and European, and this French thing about text. So I think what's interesting is to get all those different influences and make a synthesis.
Yeah, together. One thing I would say a positive with streaming services is that it's allowing me to see actors like Brazilian shows and Mexican shows and Polish shows, and whereas before I wouldn't have been able to name a Polish actor, and just to see their style.
And also the Slavic and Eastern countries have incredible schools of cinema and incredible films and performers, and also relationship to literature, and all that is incredibly enriching.
Yes. Do you think that because streaming services is making international acting available to everyone, that arts programs or acting programs are being well funded as a result, or?
Well, it's always a fight to keep funding for culture, and one can ask why, because it's so important, you know. It's really the language of peace, culture. But of course, we are still lucky here in Europe that most of, you know, the biggest schools and universities are public, and therefore available. And I think it's one of the things we have to stick to and defend.
Yeah. My mom's a music teacher, an elementary music teacher, and she talks about how funding just gets slashed.
Yes, and it's crucial.
Yeah. But one good thing, at least in the state of South Carolina, determined, because there was a talk for a while to cut arts education classes, but they decided that that couldn't be the case, but funding gets cut. But not everyone is meant to go be a lawyer or a doctor. Some people are creatives, and they're not encouraged to, maybe more so now than 60 years ago or 100 years ago, to, oh, if you're creative, if you see that in a child, go chase that. But yeah, it's hard to make
and
a living.
And then it would be very good also if doctors and and lawyers, you know, could also enjoy.
Yes, that's true.
Because and be creative.
Yeah,
everyone, you know, we all have to be creative.
Exactly. Very true. So when you got the role of Fabian in Pulp Fiction, what was that like for you?
Well, I had grown in the idea of cinema as being the seventh art, author cinema, creative cinema, and that's what I had done basically in different countries, in Portugal, here in France, and then I was just out of school when there was Phil Kaufman. Before I did Pulp Fiction, I did a film that was very important in my career, Henry and June, about Anaïs Nin and her relationship with Henry Miller. And it was Paris in between the wars, in the 20th century. And that was an incredibly creative moment here in Paris and in Europe, and all those, you know, artists and writers from all over the world gathered here. And there were these two Americans, Anaïs Nin and Henry Miller and his wife June, and there was this very intense love story between the three of them. And that was by Philip Kaufman, who is a great American director. And it was an amazing experience, a wonderful experience. And for me, it was the first experience of being in an American movie. And then a few years later, my meeting with Quentin was very nice, very sweet, because we really met in a tiny independent film festival in the south of France, in the beautiful city of Avignon.
Oh, wow.
And this American friend, who became a friend, Jerry Rudess, ran for 25 years this independent film festival. And he invited like all the names that now are very important in American cinema that were independent at the beginning. Nearly everybody went there. And so that's how I met Quentin. He was there with his first film, Reservoir Dogs. Mm. And I was there with the French film, because it was French-American.
Yeah.
And everybody was very young, with no money, and all independent, creative, artistic projects. And we had a very nice, cinephile meeting. We became friends, and then I saw him again in a much bigger festival in São Paulo, and he had seen Henry and June.
Yeah.
Actually, he took the same actresses, Uma Thurman and me.
Wow.
That was the way it happened. What was very touching is that I think I met Quentin in one of his first trips to Europe.
Okay.
He was still discovering very much everything, and I think that he wrote that in Pulp Fiction, you know, because they talk a lot about Europe, how different it is, how different names, they have different names.
The quarter pounder.
Exactly. And the Big Mac and whatever. And so it's, but it was really, really an arts film. Mm-hmm. I remember when I read the script, I immediately thought, this is a genius. Mm. This is really something very...
He's original.
So original and so creative. But I remember also thinking, I want to do this. I don't know who's going to see this.
Right.
You know, because it was so original, so different, so complex.
Yeah.
As a writing, it was a big, big script, very dense. And then the whole chronological thing, how difficult it is, you know, to follow.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to me something incredibly something very extraordinary, but I could not imagine that with all that originality he would actually speak to the whole world and conquer the whole world's attention and love for that film.
Yeah, if he called, he's working on his last film, I think, right?
I heard something.
If he called you to work on that film, would you work with him again?
Oh, I would run back, yeah, because he's such a nice person too, you know. He's such an intelligent artist, and so accurate what he writes, and he's a very good writer.
Yeah.
And actually, it was not that different from what I had known before, in the sense he's a very complete artist, and you know, I think the writing is not many people talk about that, but I think it is a signature, very important signature. He's absolutely personal and good writing.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's simple stuff, like in watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm. or even Pulp Fiction, just you're sitting there having a conversation
exactly.
about the differences between Europe and the US. How many times have many people all over the world had just simple conversations like that?
And it's true.
And you don't, I guess, to be a good writer for cinema, I'm guessing, you just take simple life situations. You don't have to think, oh, I've got to create this world of flying cars
exactly.
and aliens and this. Yeah,
it's absolutely true.
Life. Yeah,
yeah. He talks from a very humane and concrete level that we can identify immediately. And I think that's why, you know, people often say, oh, he's so incredibly violent. And actually, he's not more violent. Most of big Hollywood films are much more violent. Much more violent. But what makes it violent? It's because you are having, like, a conversation with a friend. So you are watching the movie and identifying with that conversation. And in that conversation that you can relate to as day-to-day, someone comes and shoots you. And then you say, what? No, that can't be happening. And that is very important, because he makes violence much more, our empathy, much more brutal to us, because we are identifying with the characters. We're not seeing them as completely strange creatures that we don't have nothing to do with.
That's true. You're drawn in, like Kill Bill. You're wanting Uma Thurman's character to get her son back, and by whatever means necessary. I think you have to appreciate cinema to not see it as violence, or his art as violence. I saw in an interview you did with Euronews where you said Paris is a city that still helps artists and leads in cultural production. Do you still feel that Paris is that way?
Yes, so far so good.
Yeah.
Yes, no doubt. I mean,
this is the city to come to if you're a creative, would you say, in Europe?
Yeah, it's certainly one of them. And the offer here of culture and arts is very impressive. And when you see like what's happening now with the Anatomy of a Fall.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it yet.
It's a very good movie. But it's really a fruit of the French system of help, state help to movies, and it's so important that it remains. And because if you look at art history, you know, artists always had state help. I mean, how do you do Rome? How do you do the Vatican without state help? So it is very important to preserve that.
Yeah, and I feel the Italians really led in that for many centuries.
Yeah.
Because princes were funding, mm-hmm. or families were funding art.
Yeah, and often, the highest levels of state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully we don't lose sight of that with
hopefully not.
Countries funding the arts in their, because we all need to, for me, being able to unwind after a long day is coming home, showering, putting on my PJs and watching a film. So I would hate for that to end. Do you enjoy acting or directing more?
I enjoy both, and I enjoy especially the transition, the going from one to the other, because somehow my acting experience was in a fabulous school, you know, to be able to see so many different directors, different economies also of production. You know, I did big films, I did very artistic small films, and again different languages and perspectives. It's fantastic to absorb to all that and be able to somehow then go behind the camera and give something of my vision.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a lot more work directing.
A lot more work
to be the actor.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is a lot more work, and when you finish a film and you're called to be an actor again, it's like, oh, so cool.
I remember in college, someone asked a professor, is it easier being the student to take the exam or being the professor to grade the exam? And my professor's like, it's harder to be the professor to grade the exam versus being the student to take it, because she said, I read everybody's essays first, and some essays are very long, six pages, and then I have to go back and reread again, so because I need to get an idea of where the class is, and then I can go back and grade. So I guess directing is like that too.
Yeah.
And when Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt were asked the same question, they're like, we're going to stick with acting. It would have to be a project that we feel, or they were speaking respectively, that I'm the only one, I feel that I would be the only one who could tell that story for me to be able to take it. But I'm going to leave the directing and acting to Bradley Cooper. We'll just be actors. So I can imagine. So my last question is, which projects are you working on now, if you're able to share?
Yes, I'm finishing as an actress here a French film called Le Roi Soleil, by Vincent Maël Cardona. It's very interesting script, and I'm beginning in a few days in Portugal Spanish film called La Quinta, and it's nice because it's completely different. Here we were shooting in studio and pretty dark film, in the sense, you know, with some violent scenes, and And the next one will be in countryside, garden, nice. and much more contemplation.
Yeah.
And then back to the rehearsals with Bob Wilson, okay. this show in Florence,
okay.
in Italy, about a very important Portuguese author, one of the most known, Fernando Pessoa.
Okay.
And so, yeah, and then I'm working on my next project as a director, and it's a true story, a biopic about a Portuguese woman that came from a very conservative family in Portugal. You know that Portugal until 1974 was the longest fascist dictatorship in...
Didn't realize that.
Yeah, 48 years in Europe. Mm. And we had a terrible 13-year-long colonial war
okay.
in Angola, Mozambique, Guinea. Mm. So huge territories at war.
Mm-hmm.
And... we had this in revolution that is absolutely original in 1974. So 50 years ago, mm-hmm. We had this revolution that had is completely original and different from all others because it was a military coup. It was called the Carnation Revolution. I did my first film. My first film is about it. April Captains. So these young military guys did the coup. They managed to do it. They didn't kill anybody. No violence at all. And they put a civilian democracy.
Wow.
And they didn't take the power. Anyway, but during that dictatorship. This woman was coming from the people who were ruling and so very, very dark and very fascist. And and she, because she married a diplomat, she went to Cuba and completely fell in love with Che Guevara and revolution in Cuba. So it's about
that
her.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, because there's so much contrast in her life.
And you're playing her?
No, I'm okay. writing. Okay. I won't be playing her.
Okay, that's when you're directing.
Yeah.
Wow, that must have taken a lot of research time.
A lot, and I still am researching.
Wow, it's been years of preparing for that, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's always pretty long to prepare, but for me it takes maybe even longer because I do a lot of other stuff
yeah.
as an actress, but yeah, that's what I'm preparing now.
Maybe you call Quentin to act in your film.
He's a very good actor.
Yeah, it's interesting, like in Django, I was like, is that Quentin Tarantino acting? Yeah. But yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, it was
time.
A pleasure.
For me too. I hope that you enjoyed this podcast episode and that you have found a soulful connection to the conversation. God bless you, and until the next episode, go bless somebody else.